Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people, designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor.
Welcome, everybody, again to another episode of our show. Today, bring you another really interesting guest joining us that is involved in creating a better tomorrow and some really interesting technological fronts. So, as followers of our show know, you know, we've been doing a lot of shows lately that sit at this interesting intersection of health and information technology, biosciences and IT, ag tech and IT. And a lot of this is focused on how these thought leaders ultimately use these new tools to improve efficiencies, cost, ultimately outcomes for patients, customers, and so forth. Today, we have a really interesting guest sort of joining us from the IT side of things, who's involved in building these interesting software and hardware architectures and their respective support teams for ultimately these novel tools inside one of these life science leaders, and are joined today by Dr. Pierre Fisher, who is a technology leader. He currently serves as product line lead, data storage technologies, at the pharmaceutical company Roche, where among his various responsibilities are leading the open source database strategy to help increase productivity, reduce costs, ultimately help various teams at Roche, like those of Anjali Muller, who we had on the show just a couple weeks ago, and help them to do their magic, whether it's in drug discovery, development, clinical trial selection, and all sorts of other things that are involved in getting the right drugs to the right patients faster. Dr. Fisher has a really interesting background. He got his PhD in experimental particle physics at the Louis Pasteur University in France. He spent time at CERN and their cooperative program, which allowed graduate students in their respective countries to work for various companies or research organizations. And he also did postdoc work at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. He then moved on, spent a decade in software development business at KLA Tencor, the semiconductor giant, before moving to Roche in 2013 and spending time in various roles in IT architecture, engineering operations, as well as data lifecycle management and cloud computing. We're honored to have him with us today. A lot of really interesting themes we don't normally get into. Dr. Pierre Fisher, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great having you. It's a really unique background, Pierre. And, you know, I would love to start off, I usually download the dissertation of our guest, and I take a look, and clearly, you know, when I looked at your 1997 work, study of semi-leptonic decay of beta B and D mesons and measurement of the Kabibo Kobayashi Masakawa quark index and the Delphi experiment at the Large Electron Positron Collider, you have this really cool quote again in your dissertation, Doug Adams at the Restaurant of the End of the Universe, talking about, you know, understanding the universe, and tell us a little bit about your background.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you're making fun of my thesis title, like my wife has been doing for the last 30 years. it is quite a cryptic title. I could start with, the interesting thing is what got me into particle physics is a kind of interesting story. I grew up in a very, very small village in the mountains, in the Vosges Mountains in France, 120 people, you know, and sort of my dad was the school teacher there. So to me, I was, you know, always, you know, the backyard and it was kind of the entire forest around the village. So we had tons of opportunities to go and explore, and then at night watch the stars. They had sort of the best views of the sky there. And to me, I got hooked by some comic books that I think were probably part of French propaganda at the time to promote the nuclear power program of France. But it was a fun comic book around nuclear physics and understanding the atom and how you can harness its power. And I was fascinated by that. And that kind of drove me to kind of pursue my studies, and it started my love for physics. And this is how I got into this, and really got into high energy physics, because that kind of was like, you cannot go to smaller, smaller to sort of the deepest way of understanding physics is there, basically. And then the ability to play with the biggest toys on the planet, sir. And I mean, and then at Stanford, this was just fantastic. You're on the leading edge of science, but also on technology, because you have to find solutions that have, never, there was no need for that before that. I mean, if you look at Tim Berners-Lee inventing the World Wide Web, this was because at CERN we needed ways to collaborate and exchange information with scientists all over the world. That was the initial trigger. What you see in sort of distributed computing is something that CERN had to invent as well, because of the massive amounts of data that were coming out of the experiments, and having a distributed way and a sort of hierarchized way of dealing with it was something that had to be invented at CERN also. So in a way, it was always sort of being on the pioneering edge, not just of science, but also technology. So that was really the fun part. And interestingly, for me, like, I think that drove my curiosity for a long time. But then after a postdoc, I'm kind of sitting back and realizing sort of I could satisfy my curiosity for science, physics, pretty much on the side, and not necessarily doing it just my job, because I was spending 80 to 90% of my time writing software at that point as a postdoc, and starting to having fun doing that. And being in Silicon Valley in the early 2000s, you just had to walk down the street, and there are three or four companies wanting to offer you a job at the time. And so the attractiveness of having to play with also some fun technology, and at KLA-Tencor building these electron microscope used by the semiconductor industry as the eyes of the manufacturing process. We were also driving sort of leading edge technology in electron microscopy to get to the highest resolution to be able to provide, Intel, Samsung, and the likes eyes into their manufacturing process to see, is my transistor printing correctly, and what are the defects? And so that led to so really some high-end sort of mechanical, electrical, vacuum engineering, and then software engineering to coordinate all this and to acquire and process images at the highest throughput, because you make money by providing results most quickly, in this case. And so to me, that was a sort of a great combination of sort of my physics background, and then putting to good use my skills as a software engineer. And interestingly, I found myself there developing cores in electron microscopy and teaching software engineers about electron microscopy, because that was the most useful thing, because those were smarter engineers, software engineers, than I was, but they lacked the actual context of what their software was supposed to do, to be controlling and doing. And so this is where I said I always found myself in these positions, it's sort of in a bridge between sort of the scientific and the engineering world there. And that was also a lot of fun, especially sort of having the satisfaction that I could help, be have make these people a lot more productive and a lot more knowledgeable with what they had to deliver. This is also what I got my first forays into outsourcing and creating a software engineering team from scratch, pretty much in India. So and working across the across the ocean with the team in the US. And so it was also a big human experience in trying to bridge the two worlds. And then, I mean, in the end, it was an experiment to, oh, no, not an experiment, but we're looking to capitalize on the low cost of people's salaries
Sure.
in India. But you're trying to do this in a super high context environment. So, and trying to get people who do regular software engineering to build software to control some really high-end piece of technologies, that was a whole experiment as well. Took years to actually get there, but this is one of the proud moment in my career, actually. It was to actually bring that team along and to really find the model that would help, you know, people grow into their job there, and to get the benefit of having this outsourced team, but also to not impact the productivity and the delivery of what we were trying to deliver on. So, and that experience has proven super useful in my job at Roche as well, where we work in a completely global environment with teams scattered across the planet as well. And then, you know, the switch to the pharma world, that was kind of an interesting one after many, many years spent in Silicon Valley. I mean, both my wife and I are from the Basel area, very
Sure.
close to there, and we were longing to be closer to our extended family, and we decided to relocate. And I took actually a year off when we did this to support my wife, who was the first one who found a job there. And so I took care of our young kids, and it was great time to me to also have a bit of free time. I think a lot of people would kill for having mid-career the ability to take a year off, and then to reflect on, you know, what is the next stage and what, you know, new ambitions you have, and or, you know, how you want to have fun in your career. So I had that privilege. I'm still very, very thankful to my wife for, taking care of the salaries and bringing home
Right.
the salary, and for me to have that opportunity to do that. And this is how I ended up, you know, sort of applying to Roche and to getting into the world of IT infrastructure.
Right.
And this is an interesting thing, because this is actually basically the providing all the basic tools that your software engineers are actually need in order to deploy and run their solutions. And that was a big steep learning curve for me, because in the previous company at KLA-Tencor, we were taking care of this in such a small scale, because it's a much smaller company, and having to do this for a company that has 100,000 plus employees doing this at scale globally. You have to apply a level of structure and professionalism to it to do it in an efficient way, especially when you have compliance and regulatory requirements on top of that for you for IT. Yeah? And yeah, and from there, I think this is where a lot of my sort of focus started shifting on how do you build and operate, you know, large scale solutions with cost effectiveness as one of the drivers for sure, but also, you know, providing, you know, the fit for purpose capability that your developers or your deployers of applications need in the higher stacks of the IT chain. And this is also where, you know, at the same time, watching my kids grow up and sort of, you know, them asking questions about the planet and its future. And for me, as a sort of avid scuba diver, seeing the deterioration of the oceans, I think to me there was sort of an additional sort of awareness and that sort of turning point in a way where I started thinking about, you know, how do I actually, through my job, also have an impact on you know, the sustainability and of our planet. And this is, you know, in recent years, that's been something that I've been really, you know, trying to embed in the things that we do. You can see it on my background here. It's delete data you do not need, save the earth.
Right.
It's a little tagline I've had for the last 3 years in my chat and, you know, and Zoom background. That was one of the first ones to kind of go and model what is the footprint, the CO2 footprint of a terabyte of data sitting on our infrastructure, just to start raising awareness.
Right.
And then one of the things that I realized early on here is actually in there's always a quick win that, you know, everybody first assumes that doing things green or sort of reducing emissions is something that usually costs additional money. You know, it's like, you know, you're going to buy groceries and you're going to the produce section in the supermarket. The organic stuff is more expensive than the non-organic stuff. You know? It has less pesticides, so therefore the, you know, the yields are lower, or thus it's more expensive. Actually, with IT, interestingly, I think in a lot of cases, sustainability and cost efficiency are actually going together. And especially in the world that I live in, we're with data storage, because, you know, the more efficient you are with your data, you know, if you life cycle your data, you don't keep around data you do not need, then you don't need as much storage. And if you don't need as much storage, then you don't have to power it up. And then you're also not responsible for those embedded emissions of creating that storage infrastructure in the first place.
Right.
So there's actually a big quick win there in a way, which is to realize that, managing things efficiently in terms of infrastructure is actually a something that has a high positive impact on emissions as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when I was talking to Anjali about you originally, you know, she brought up this theme about sustainability in your operation and ultimately, you know, what you were just saying in terms of storage. What are some of the other areas? I mean, 'cause, you know, here I am, I have my computer, I'm sitting on it. This is the only computer I know. But when it comes to some of these other tools, whether it's the more advanced computers, where we're headed, these artificial intelligence tools, the large language models, all this new stuff, what are some of the areas that we may not be aware of that, hey, you know, this is a problem. I mean, obviously we hear about sort of Bitcoin mining and all that. That's a big problem, but that's not part of Roche's business. Other interesting areas where there's wins along this sort of line per sustainability in these computer architectures, these software architectures.
Yeah. I mean, the large language model one is an interesting one because, there are some estimates around, I think I was reading that recently, that just to train one large language model is a huge CO2 impact because you need to mobilize a large amounts of graphical processing unit and GPUs. And those are very energy hungry. And it's the orders of kilotons of CO2 emissions just to train one model. And then, you know, once it's trained on a daily basis, I think it was one article I wouldn't be able to quote. Yeah, don't quote me on this, but I think I remember reading it was like 24 tons of CO2 equivalent on a daily basis for the usage of ChatGPT-3. With that probably scales with the number of users too, right?
Sure.
So, but that gives you, just a quick idea there, and anything that requires these high-end computing resources is definitely going to be responsible for a lot of emissions. And I think therefore the question is like everybody's jumping on to train and have their own brand of large language models. And to me, the question is like, yeah, you should ask yourself whether that's a wise thing to do, compared to looking at one that already exists and reusing that because the training is highly impactful. Now, mind you, if you look at the large public cloud hyperscalers, Google, Amazon, and Azure, they have all of these resources on hand already sitting idle. So the what we call the embedded emissions from having built this, it's already been spent. So the damage is already done in a way, to some extent. And but it's still, that just the power to the computing power is huge to run them.
So that's, obviously that's one area, and I know that, you on a daily basis have to think about, whether you build something in-house at Roche, whether we'll keep going back to Anjali's business here of, we use AI to, we want to discover this new drug, we want to pick the right patients and all that stuff. On the other hand, companies like Roche, as we continue to develop in this precision medicine era of storing the every piece of information about the genome and our transcriptome and the proteome and all this imaging stuff, there's so much more out there that is going to be part of, like, one of the things we talked about a little bit was the digital twin concept, that there's going to be this thing sitting there one day and it's got a lot of damn information in it on me, and then multiply that by a few billion people. Say a few words about that side of things as well. I mean, obviously you got the processing needs for all the AI and that stuff, but you got some really serious storage needs coming up in the coming years with at a group like Roche.
And for almost 3 years, I was in charge of the whole storage for the scientific research groups at Roche. And one interesting thing is, yeah, I mean, you see the data footprint, it doubles pretty much every 16 to 24 months. And actually, I mean, Roche is no different than many companies, actually, not just in life science. If you talk to Gartner, they'll tell you the same thing. So it's an explosion of data. And you have to look at different strategies to kind of make it sustainable, I mean, financially and then sustainably as well. I mean, from a sustainable point of view as well. And there are different things. I mean, my previous role was called data lifecycle management. And I think that's a big part of the solution, which is that in the past you just select one type of storage, which was the highest performance storage, which you use when your data is active and you're actively working on it. And so you need to read it at the highest throughput possible. And but that you realize that with the research sort of cycles is that data will be used intensely for a short period of time at the very beginning when it's acquired or created, and then after that mostly it'll sit there and not being touched because people are process their results and they're looking at secondary data or tertiary data. And then sometimes they'll come back because some improvements have been done in the analysis pipeline, and then they'll rerun everything. But that might be a year from now, or 2 years from now. And then there's data that you keep around for 15, 20 years because you have requirements to keep that around for potential audits or as evidence of what has been done. And so with that you realize this, you need the active storage only for a short period of time. And this is where we implemented a tiering strategy where you actually move around your data to colder storage. And if you work natively in the public cloud, these are options that are natively available, where, you know, you turn on the option and your data is being monitored for its activity, and then it's getting automatically to colder storage that doesn't use as much energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in some cases, it ends up in something like optical drives, which don't
right.
even require power if you don't access the data. So that's one of the strategies. The other one is, I think, is something that I'm pushing at the moment with our whole architecture chapter, is to adopt some what I call data minimization principles.
Okay.
Because a lot of times, you know, when people are in a hurry, you know, you're just going to copy your data over and over. I mean, I think people who work with spreadsheets are probably, you know, familiar with that, you know, looking at how many copies of that you have. And I think this, there are many, you end up with, you know, 5 or 6 copies of that same data, which then, you know, multiplies by 5 the storage that you need. And so, you know, having an established system of records and a pattern like a data hub, which is the place where people can find the data and then have a central access to it. And you can that way sort of minimize the total footprint of a particular piece of information. So there's a lot of different things there. I mean, maybe one of the messages there is that there's no silver bullet. You have
sure.
multiple things that you need to put in place in order to minimize that footprint.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to sort of this storage architecture and some of the strategies you're using to, again, minimize it, keep the footprint down, there's other pieces to this, let's say IT game that we profile on the show, things like, and I know we're not there yet. I know we don't have formal quantum computers yet, but we've had people on the show that have talked about sort of the quantum light stuff that's out there in terms of where we're going with some of this processing capacity. As you were just mentioning, the optical stuff, talked a little bit about, you know, what's happening there as we evolve into whatever the thing is, 5.5, 6G, and the ability to need to move around a lot of this stuff fast in large amounts. Talk about what gets you excited in terms of, you know, the processing technologies and the, I guess, the networking technologies that we're going to be having to deal with in 5 years, in 10 years, as we get into these really unique spaces.
Yeah, obviously, from my background in you know, nuclear and physics, I studied quantum physics quite a bit. And so the quantum computing stuff, for me, it's fascinating. I think this is super exciting. I mean, I'm part of a small working group we have in the company where we've looked at what are some of the problems that you can solve with quantum computing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
And then to look at, you know, what is the expertise that we need to put in place internally mm-hmm. for people to be able to design the algorithms and then write the software that we're going to, in order to be able to leverage quantum computers when they actually, you know, come of age for practical use case in life science. I mean, to me, I think that can be a game changer for certain use cases, for sure. To me, there's some things that I find also fascinating in terms of storage, because it's kind of for a life science company, that's kind of a going full circle, that, you know, there are companies who have, you know, showcased and how you can use DNA as a way to store data for long term. And to me, this is the thing. We're trying to unlock the secrets of DNA and I mean, and genomics and put that to use for therapies. But then, you know, you look at, you know, in IT, we might actually be leveraging that as a technology to store data for the long term. So that's another one. I mean, it's kind of impractical to at the moment from a throughput perspective. But it's fascinating how much, you know, density you can, you know, you have there and the amount of information that you can store.
So, Pierre, one of the things that we've chatted about, which you're really, passionate about in your mission is, again, the theme of sustainability is one part of it. As you said, sustainability not being an afterthought, not a side thing, a really important point of all these processes as you develop them from startup. Talk a little bit about what that means, for you and your mission moving forward.
Because I mean, usually when people start is looking at the systems you already have and trying to optimize what you have there, but that only gets you so far. And to me, the important thing is that the solutions that we built, you live with them for sometimes 5, 10, 20 years, huh? So I think it's super important and critical that those are designed with sustainability built in. And that's a big movement I'm trying to create at the moment, and we're really working and trying to influence our architecture chapter in IT to adopt these design for sustainability practices and principles that we can embed in everything that we do in the solutions that we build, but also in the solutions that we source. So just passing that on and partnering with our vendors and our suppliers. And one interesting thing here is that, interestingly, there are a lot of people who are thinking about these topics as well in different parts of the organization. And there was a little bit of a grassroots movement is what started this. And one of the things that we did do is kind of start by creating a little bit of a forum where at least we can connect
Right.
and exchange ideas. With Angelie that you've met also, we got a great support as well because she's also very very energized, and also
Sure.
she also wants us to build that in and because she feels that that's very important. And so now I think we're trying to leverage her and then also her support, but also trying to gain influence at the highest level of the decision making in IT. Because I think you need to sort of help structure a sort of a grassroots movement with some top-down support as well. And that's one of the things that we're working on at the moment. And but it's we're starting to put these new concepts in practice and taking an agile approach, iteratively, like I said earlier, like you design a little experiment, something that you want to test in a small environment, for example, with these design principles, we're testing them on storage at the moment, but with the idea that these can then be expanded overall to all of the different IT resources. And then we're also starting to engage and with our partners externally for them to contribute as well, because a lot of our IT systems are not things that we built from the scratch ourselves.
That gets me thinking because I asked this question to a lot of our health IT folks that we have on the show. I talked again with Anjali about it. At the end of the day, I had a friend that worked in the venture capital space a couple of years ago. They were telling me, at the time there was, I forget how many hundreds of companies that were trying to sell something to big pharma companies that had something to do with AI and drug development. I mean, obviously, as you were just pointing out, whether it's a, hey, I got a DNA computer here or I got a pre-quantum computer here, you got to evaluate this stuff and you got to stay up to speed with it because you're not. Well, maybe you are building it. You want to build it all internally at Roche, or maybe you want X, Y, and Z startups to help you. Talk a little bit about how you stay ahead of the curve with some of this stuff, because clearly, just like Anjali has, those technologies knock on the door. You obviously have a lot of small startups that come to your shop and say, "Hey, I got the next tool for you." How do you triage all that stuff?
I mean the first thing I think is we are fortunate to work for a company that has been successful because of the amount of it invests in research and fundamental research, huh? So there's a really sort of a culture of experimentation of being open to new ideas and finding new solutions now to the problems that we haven't been able to solve just yet. So I think that's the first thing, is that there's already sort of a culture and environment that is conducive to experimentation. No?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that, you know, like you pointed out, I mean, there are hundreds of companies that are always, you know, knocking at the door, pitching their new ideas. And, but then when you look at it this way, you know, most of the time that we end up with a solution in search of a problem. And what I found, you know, for me was more successful is actually to first, you know, really cross-functionally come together within the company to understand what are the problems that really don't have a good solution today. I mean, the example here with quantum computing is it started out with like, what are the problems that are computational problems that are almost impossible to solve today in life science? Like one of them is like protein folding, for example. Huh? And this one, you can actually, you know that they're, you know, the quantum computers will be a great tool to tackle that. I mean, we're not there to the point where we can do a proof of concept and a really experimentation there. But I think this is where I think, you know, being clear on what are the problems that you have that you can't solve today. And then also just to not just stay within ourselves. I think it's a super important part is to reach out and be connected with other peers in the industry and to exchange and to evaluate whatever is coming, you know, all these startups. I mean, when they come knocking on the door, this, you know, sometimes they actually point problems that you don't even realize you had. But the key is then, you know, is really, you know, design and, you know, take a scientific approach, design the experiment to prove the hypothesis and then go from there. I mean, that's something that stuck with me from the earlier part of my career is, you have a well-designed experiment. You don't have to spend years designing it, but actually have a hypothesis that you want to test and evaluate, you know, the solution based on that.
Pierre, you sent me, you know, some different materials to review, to in preparing to talk to you intelligently about some of this stuff. One of the videos, I think it's, I saw it in your LinkedIn account, was a Roche video was called about, you know, data culture, and sort of this theme across the organization. What else is happening in sort of the domain of data culture per the Roche organization, and also, you know. Because I just like everything else, you got to get out there, you got to network, you got to go to the conferences and stay up to date with everything that's happening. Say a few words about that and what it means to sort of build both internally and externally a data culture at an organization that, you know, as large and old as Roche. I mean, it's been around for a while.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, we're kind of lucky, again, being in a company that, you know, is doing evidence-based research. Huh? I mean, you don't put a drug on the market if it hasn't been thoroughly evaluated, you know, with a very rigorous process of data collection through clinical trials and, you know, the design experiments, you know, what you're going to test and, you know, very rigorous statistical analysis of your results and understanding all the different factors that can affect your results. Huh? So in a way, there's a sort of a backbone already of having a strong data culture that, you know, you make evidence-based decisions. And that is, you know, pretty strong in the portfolio, you know, of our drug portfolio. Where interestingly, you have a completely different world is when you go to what we call the enterprise world, where you have big ERP systems where you record, you know, all the transactions and, you know, have a good understanding of the different processes that flow through your company. But in a way, you know, the data culture there is still based on, you know, I look at a financial report, I make a decision in within my silo based on that. And there are other areas where people fly, you know, pretty blind without much data. And I think the idea, I think what we're trying to achieve is to take that very strong data culture that you see in the drug portfolio and to say, hey, actually, that works. And we should be running the whole business that way, in a way. And then we should also look at, you know, making every bit of data that we have that has been proved valuable within one domain as something that we productize, where, you know, it's and treat it like a product, which is that it's maintained and it's shoppable, and you know, you understand what you get. You know, there's a paper that explains you how to use it and all that, and then you make it available for anyone else in the company to at least discover, understand what it is, and then request access to it, you know? So that you can actually then start looking at maybe. You know, I do sentiment analysis on social data that comes in from all the social platforms and monitor what's happening in terms of comments towards a particular therapeutic area or one of our drugs and look at what is the sentiment there. And then you can look at, you know, looking at, you know, can you inform, you know, supply chain and production based on, because the interest in that drug is rising in some area that may mean that, you know, it's gaining traction in particular areas. So it can inform different kinds of strategy, but you're starting to correlate pieces of information that were completely disconnected before that. And that's a sort of big ambition here, is to kind of unleash the power of that data by you know, allowing to aggregate it in very different ways than were possible before.
It's fascinating to watch some of these tools, you know, as they make their way through organizations, you know, like Roche, and I was saying before about digital twins, that, you know, here's something that's obviously for patients, but then, you know, you will be using these same digital twin tools to for efficiencies on the manufacturing floor in country X, and stratify patients in country Y, and there's just so many really interesting applications as you get through this amazing phase of digitization across what is in essence started as a life sciences company, and you know, it's becoming this really interesting hybrid you know, that you're mentioning.
I mean, to me, it's been interesting because the world of physics, if you look at the 1970s, you know, an experiment in high energy physics was based on what we call bubble chambers, these big hydrogen chambers where your particles would fly through and then they would generate little bubbles. You take a picture of that. And then you had armies of people who would just then sort of measure those traces. Huh? And there was a big breakthrough in digitalization when George Charpak, who got a Nobel Prize for it, invented the multi-proportional wire chambers, basically, where you have your particle goes through gas and there's a mesh of wires there, and the gas ionizes, the electrical current is measured by the wires, and then you can kind of triangulate where the particle came in, and you get digital signals to reconstruct the trajectory of a particle. And suddenly, then you can put computers to work there.
Right.
And that happened in the 1970s. And for me, like when I joined Roche in 2013, I was still watching a ton of things. We're doing, you know, paper trails everything was done. And then watching how, you know, we started with robotic process automation and then process digitalization. And this is still undergoing. It's like, I mean, for me, it's like scroll back, you know, 20, 30 years, the digitalization revolution I saw in physics was starting to happen in life science, where people were starting to use electronic lab notebooks instead of paper notebooks. And it's interesting that I think life science sort of came pretty late in this movement, actually. I was surprised, actually.
It'd be interesting to see how it all evolves now, but no, it's really interesting. So Pierre, per the introduction of the show, you started in high energy particle physics. You went through semiconductors and obviously software and hardware and then into life sciences. I want to loop back around now. And again, I mentioned in your PhD, you got this quote from Restaurant at the End of the Universe. There is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something more bizarre and inexplicable. And there's another theory which states that that has already happened. I bring this up because there's this guy, I think his last name is Musk or something. He announced an artificial intelligence initiative a couple of days ago, focused at, questioning some of the big problems out there and, big questions we still have about the universe. If I was to give you a lump of money to go back into high energy particle physics and explore some of those unknown problems, what are you going to focus on? What still interests you in that? Because clearly, that's not something that you lose passion in. It is a, one of those frontiers that we still got a lot of questions to ask and find out answers.
I mean, I think to me it, interestingly, because when you look at, what's happened in the sort of 20, 25 years since I left the field, is that any new discoveries, like oscillations of neutrinos, the Higgs boson, and these are all been sort of just confirmation of the standard model of elementary particles. And, the more precise the measurements get, the more, sort of it refines our understanding of the model. But what I was trying to do in this measurement I did in my thesis was this, it's like, yeah, there's this triangle and it's supposed to be unitary. And so by measuring all the parameters of that triangle, we might be able to find out it's not unitary, and then there's a violation of a fundamental symmetry, which would tell us something that that breaks the model. And to me, my measurement only sort of contributed a tiny bit in that field, but I think it's been the sort of this ever this continued quest where we continue to refine, but we haven't been able to find a smoking gun that says, look, that model is a great approximation, because it explains everything we've been able to measure, but underlying, it's unsatisfactory because there's so many parameters that we have to measure to plug into the model to make it work. And it's kind of and that's, it's kind of a sign that there's probably some underlying deeper representation of the universe and how it works that we haven't been able to apprehend yet, huh? And so to me it's like, yeah, designing some experiment that would finally allow us to gain a new insight on what's really behind that. And I know, like, I mean, that would definitely be one thing that would be exciting. But and the other one, which is the big thing at the moment, I mean, I think, the confirmation of gravitational waves and back in, I think it was in 2017, and then just a recent announcement that there's actually sort of a cosmic background of gravitational wave that was confirmed. And to me, there's that deep question whether gravitation is something that really obeys sort of the similar structure. It may not be the right word, but let's use that structure that the other forces are following, which you can quantize that, and that,
Quantization theory.
yeah, quantization. That, quantum, nobody has figured out a way to prove whether you can quantize them, do graviton exist or, yes or no. I mean, that to me, that's a fascinating question as well.
Well, it is, whether we're talking about, quantization of gravity or what consciousness is or any of these major questions. I mean, I'm glad we're, we still, there's folks out there like yourselves that still think about them. And, as these tools evolve, and continue to get better and faster and more sustainable, that we'll have answers, or we'll get closer and closer to answers, to these problems and solve a lot of things that plague her. Any final messages while I have you? Clearly you have such a diverse skill set there. It's exciting to hear what you're doing, what you've been doing. Anything hot coming up that we should know about for either your group or anything else you're involved in, please.
Yeah, I mean, anything hot? I don't, nothing comes to mind,
Conference
but just,
conferences, talks you're going to be giving, any interesting travel?
no, I have to say, I'm shifting my focus at the moment to figure out how to help, people who are starting in their careers to find their passion.
Good.
I mean, it's also really the fact my kids are, 12 and 14, and, sort of they're asking themselves these questions. And to me, I'm trying to, get them excited about, the and in awe of the world around them. But also for me, like, it's always been super important to help bring opportunities to people who are starting in their career. I got my break, through a chance encounter with people who decided to bet on me and sort of give me opportunities. And to me, this is, I want to sort of provide a way to give back as well and provide others with the opportunities. Because I mean, for me, I'm the little kid I was mentioning from, growing up in this village in the mountains. And who would have thought that, 20 years after that, I would find myself, in Silicon Valley working, and I think to me, like, I wish that opportunity on anyone, whether they seize it or not, that's for them then. But I think because I think, the answer to those questions we were just discussing earlier, I think my brain's too old now to figure it out. I think I'd rather put my money on sort of bright kids somewhere, anywhere on the planet, because,
I'm in the same boat as you. I have three. They're a few years older, but nonetheless, whatever they, it's sort of like a little side thing I do for this show. I mean, the show is obviously to spread the word about great thinkers and innovators, but at the same time, it's for me to say, hey, if one of my kids asks about data sustainability, I'd say, hey, go watch this episode of Pierre Fisher, and you'll get some idea of sort of where things are going. So yeah, no, I applaud you for that. Obviously, you're still capable of thinking about these big problems. At the same time, the ability to mentor, the ability to send a positive message to that next generation of STEM thought leaders is so important. And I think that's another great part of what you've done, and show the diversity of what's possible, how one can start in high energy particle physics and then work on the big problems of disease and unmet medical needs. I think it's just a great story. And yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to come talk about it and what you've been up to and sending a positive message out. Again, for everybody that is going to be listening to this particular episode of our show across the various podcast networks or watching on the YouTube channel, again, you've been listening to Dr. Pierre Fisher, technology leader, product line lead, data storage technologies at Roche. Pierre, I want to thank you again for taking the time out of your schedule to come talk for a little while about this wide-ranging set of topics. Obviously, thank you for everything you're up to. And as we like to say on our show, thanks for helping to create and inspire a better tomorrow via what you do. It's a really interesting story.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity. That was fun.
Absolutely. Great having you.